John Boker tape, October 1st, 1990, Ishpeming, with Roger Lane. Branch Danielson, right.
Danielson.
From his friend, can I say?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
His friend. I knew most of these guys.
Did you?
Yeah. I was a kid. There used to be characters all over. The characters are disappearing, the local characters. They're out-talked by the TV and the rest of it. It's changed.
Mm-hmm.
They're hard to find. They're in nursing homes or dead or something. But the real old local characters, you probably had them where you lived as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And the place was crawling with them when I was a kid. And I must have had an urge that I was attracted to them. They weren't teachers telling you to shut up and study and this and that. They were local characters of all kinds. Some of them were, they were fanatics in a way. Fanatics of booze and Big Annies.
How would you like to be Judge Souter down there in Congress? How would you like to go through the confirmation process? How would you have liked it when you were appointed back in?
I think I would have not taken it as well as he did, or as calmly as he did.
Can you imagine?
I probably wouldn't have been a judge. And I'd have covered it with some blink, blink words. Bleak, bleak, bleak. Take and shove, fellas.
Can you imagine Charlie Feaster sitting there in front of you and you're in the chair and the lights are bright and he's saying, "Now, Mr. Boker, what is this about you wrote in the book about Big Annie? Will you kindly explain all this to us again? We're trying to determine your fitness to be a judge." Can you imagine that?
Yeah. This Anatomy of a Murder thing came out while I was on the bench. I had written it beforehand. I was a DA for 14 years up here, prosecuting attorney, we call it poetically in Michigan. And one of the biggest counties east of the Mississippi, and mixed logging, mining, God knows what, farming, this, that. And there were still justices of peace in those days, some of whom couldn't even read, let alone speak English. And I traveled around these various counties, the townships, and the hell was I going to...
Well, we're talking about what happened to the old characters and how they got crowded out by television, and you were recalling the way it was back in the 40s and the 50s.
Yeah, that's right. And earlier, I'm an old guy. I'm 87, old F-A-R-Q.
You know, I suppose you do, that you come out of the same law firm. That's just a sticker to remind you of the guy's name. You come out of the same law firm as Adlai Stevenson. Did you happen to cross paths with him? Was he there when you were?
No. What law firm?
Mayer, Meyer, Austin, and...
Adlai.
Adlai Stevenson
was... If I knew that, I had forgotten it, because I was an admirer of his. He was an unusual candidate, guy.
He may have been there before you came.
He must have been. What's your name?
Roger Lane.
From his friend Roger Lane, L-A-N-E.
Correct.
Some spell it L-A-I-N-E, it's like Joanne or Joanna, you know, of St. Roger Lane. Brent Anderson from his friend Roger Lane, along with the best wishes. I tend to run on.
That's all right.
Best wishes of. I won't get into the judge thing.
No.
Roger Lane, along with the best wishes. Author. How about that?
Very good.
Television, you see a show on that. The show is created, written by somebody, created by somebody, produced by somebody. I mean, it sounds too complicated for words. Everybody wants his name in the,
And God help the man that wants to pick out the author. He might miss him when that cascade of 35 names comes on the screen.
Well, the very fact that there's so many hands in it is telling you that it must be allowed. It would be a miracle if the story were intelligible at all. It takes one person, I guess, to really spin a yarn that tells a story, I guess. I don't know.
Well, that's the wonder of mankind and our civilization. The product of one man, not a committee.
That's
what
right.
One man
that's
can do, right. What you do.
That's right. Wow. An accident. I learned to spell. My parents were mixed. My mother came here as a music teacher in the public schools.
To Ishpeming?
She was from away. Her background, her maiden name was Traver, which I took when I began spinning yards. I was DA then, and I thought it might be a little impolitic for the voters to think that the busy DA was spinning yarns on taxpayers' time. So that's how I had to get this Traber name. And finally I was stuck with it.
So when was the first, when was that Northwoods DA, when was that book published, do you remember?
That was my third book.
It was
after Daddy. The first one was Troubleshooter. I wrote two DA books. And someday I expect they'll be on television, because this is a devouring wolf, television is. They'll get to it. CBS once had it right up to a deal, but somebody found some swear words in the book. Oh my goodness. And there's still grumblings. Most of my books are out of print. A couple of the fishing books are still. There was a picture book, a fishing book. You remember that?
Was that Laughing White? No, that was Trout.
Anatomy of a Fisherman.
Oh.
Pictures by an all-time life photographer called Kelly. It was his idea. And I guess picture books are expensive to print nowadays, like everything else.
They are. You know, there's been a transformation in the whole publishing business.
Yeah.
You talk about being out of print. Well, that's
not,
the way.
Not all to the good, by the way.
Right.
I mean, publishing contracts now, the publisher tells you what he'll allow your book to be published on his terms. I mean, it used to be a certain percentage of this, that, and the other thing. subsidiary rights. St. Martin's Press that published The Atomir Murder had but 15% of the movie rights cut on my take of the movie rights.
Oh, is that right?
Now it's 50%. Any contract I've signed since then, and I think they're right. If a book isn't published, there aren't going to be many subsidiary rights from it.
That's true.
So the publisher who brought it out mm-hmm. has some argument for the birth, I guess.
He's the midwife.
That's right. That's right. Let's see, John Balker. Anyway, she met a tall saloon keeper with a German name who apparently fascinated her, and they married. And I'm the youngest of six sons. He was a widower then with three sons. I'm the youngest of the six and the last.
Was he a saloon keeper here in Ishpeming or somewhere else?
Ishpeming.
So your whole life, from birth on, relates to this place.
I was born in town in an old frame house. It's still there. We rent it so that we don't have to tear it down. It pays the taxes. It's a block from the Carnegie Public Library.
Is that right on the main road now, or is it off?
No, Barnum Street. And as a kid, my mother taught me to go to the library and read. And I think reading is one of the best ways to educate kids that there is. Reading, communication of other people over the years. Not that I started out with high-floating authors. I went through the Rober Boys and Alger stories and this, that. But I've been reading, and I got a little familiar with using words. Not judicial words, I think. As you know, one of the problems with judicial opinions is so many of them are so goddamn unreadable.
They're written for the author and a couple of lawyers, not
And part of it is inevitable. I mean, these phrases and idioms and judicial talk have now been interpreted so long that you stand it. If you try to rephrase it in plain English, you're liable to lose your case and your client. You've got to use some of this, the bottom line parameters. I mean, there's a lot of, the way politicians talk, a good deal of the law opinions mm-hmm. have been. I think the bar, as you know, Fred Baker said he's a good friend of yours.
Right.
And he is interested in, I guess, trying to ease legal and judicial England.
He is. You know, he is, as you undoubtedly know, the main force in the Michigan Bar Journal, and there's been an attempt in recent years to...
He's a very interesting guy, and encouraging to see a young lawyer like him. Shall I date it?
Why don't you?
'Tis October 1st.
1st of October.
I could say UP.
Sure.
UP or bust. I put on my old car, UP or bust, years ago.
Tell me, how did you ever happen to run for public office the first time? Now, and what was the year of that? Do you remember? Was it when you ran for prosecutor the first time? Is that your first public office try? Or did you
run? I got to it. October 1st. AD. It's for me, oh yeah.
Do you want me to take that from you? Are you through that now?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll just drop it over here.
You want this?
No, that was just for helpers.
I know. Yep, yep.
You come up from Chicago, and that would have been...
The reason I was in Chicago, I met a girl, this lady. Is she here? Did you speak, Grace?
Oh, yes, yes, at the door, right.
I met her in my senior year of law school at a dance. I mean, we breed racehorses with great care and all this, but romance, love. So, she was from Illinois, Oak Park, Hemingway's town, near Chicago. Well, here I was, a cynical senior in law school, you know, and toppled at the crease dance at the law school was still farther down State Street. It was the law club, which has since become the law school of the whole works. Anyway, I graduated, came up here, and worked as assistant DA for a while with a prosecutor, an excellent prosecutor for his time, a fireball of a lawyer, you know, a Mike Wallace prosecutor. There are many. I never was that way, but he was, and it was his way, and he was damn good at it. And then,
did you succeed him? Did he drop out or go somewhere else, and then you ran for his spot? Is that the way it worked?
Yeah, he ran for Congress. On the Republican ticket. This was in the FDR days, early New Deal, and up here the unions were sprouting and this, that, and the other thing. He was defeated and he moved west. And I think ran out there, and he was a terrific guy. And I say part of his problem, he was naturally a Republican when he started, but he was not a conservative Republican. He was a fireball of a guy with his own ideas, but he couldn't very well turn back then. He was marked, the Republican candidate. Anyway, I left there and went to Chicago and married the girl. And I didn't know it when this chemistry began in Ann Arbor, that her father happened to be in one of the big downtown banks. I did not know that. Well, it worked out that he waved a wand and Hadley Stevenson's law firm gave me a job as a peasant back in the bullpen, we call it, where the young lawyers stayed, four or five of us in one big room. I stayed there about 3 years. And one thing I learned was how to look up law. A lot of young lawyers, I don't know what they, but at that time, we didn't have much experience in looking up law, chasing down a theory or a case or whatever. And finally I learned that I didn't like cities. I still don't. I hate to even see them. I think they are uninhabitable. That's a large, but and more and more the proof is coming on that this may be true. Strangers colliding with each other, and now they found guns and drugs and God knows what. Not that there isn't drugs and crime in smaller communities, but at least you can get the hell away from the crowd. I can. I have a little camp on a pond here. It's only a few miles from my big airport, K.I. Sawyer Airport. But when I get there, I'm to hell and gone away from the crowd. There's still trees and bears and deer and foxes and not many wolves anymore, but I used to see them. I had to come home, and I ran for DA, and I ran on FDR's ticket.
Would that be in 34, do you remember, 36 or right
34.
Around? 34.
Oh, wait a minute, when was Roosevelt in 32?
Well, he's first 32. Elected in 32.
Yeah.
But
well, 34, I ran as DA, and with a big bunch of candidates for the nomination. There were two or three on each ticket. It happened that I was the only one that happened to be born and raised here.
The others were carpetbaggers, were they?
Well, they were. I mean, there were kids that moved in. I don't say it critically, but it happened that I was the only one. And I used that. And campaigning was different then. You went around and visited the voters. You went to the mines and the here, there, the corset factory and wherever the hell, and you had meetings in townships and you communicate with the voters instead of speaking into a microphone on television accusing your opponents of eating crackers in bed. And similar crummy charges. I'm quoting from something I wrote recently.
Press the flesh. Who was it that talked about pressing the flesh?
I forget. I remember the phrase. Yeah.
Well, that's what you're talking about, isn't it?
Hand-to-hand
contact.
I did it for 14 years. And finally I was beaten by a young kid that never tried a case.
What were the circumstances of that?
Well, it was a switch. It was a... I mean, there are local and state... I mean, politics is fluid. It isn't only a personal race. It's sometimes swayed by this, that.
Would that have been 48? Would that have been the time of the Republican high expectations? Because
maybe so. Maybe it was 50.
50?
I lost by 7 votes.
Oh.
And I thought, well, a recount. And then I finally realized that I wanted out. But by then I had 3 children. 2 of them were in college. And I had, between my fishing and yarn spinning and and DAing, I didn't have much time to build a private practice.
Had you benefited financially from any of your writings at that time?
No.
You were then sort of on your uppers, right? You were.
I had three books, two DA books and these Danny books that had appeared and been respectfully, you know, not clobbered by the critics, mm-hmm. but they died a natural death like most books, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. then at least. And so I tried, let's see.
Now that would have been...
Oh, wait a minute, I'm trying to...
Was it 50?
This was in 50s. And I tried, I ran for Congress.
You ran against Frank Hook one time, didn't you?
For the nomination, yeah.
He was a well-known fellow up here, wasn't he?
He was a well-known guy that was losing to somebody called Bennett.
Oh!
Mm-hmm. Yeah, John Bennett.
John Bennett.
And
Bennett was a Republican, right?
That's right. And there was a trend towards the Republicans. And I thought maybe I might be able to take Bennett because Hook had problems, including Buzola and a few other problems. I didn't make it. So then I tried, this was after the war, uranium looking, it was supposed to be uranium up here, they found some in Canada and So I bought a Geiger counter on 18 easy payments, you know. And three of us went out and I found them out in the thorium. For a week we were billionaires. A mouth sent the Geiger just squeaking, squealing. Except that the people came out from Washington, you know, and authorities, and they told us, yes, it is radioactive, yes, it can do everything else the thorium can, but our system is geared to thorium. In other words, we were going to blow ourselves up with thorium instead of, or uranium instead of thorium. So that failed, Congress failed, and then came a trial. And the trial is what I wrote about. And the young DA defended, he had little experience in court, so he got a young, he got a well experienced assistant attorney general up from Lansing to help him. That's it.
Now, you were the defense lawyer in that trial?
I was. And I, it's pretty much the story of the trial. There are some slight changes. For one thing, I didn't have an older lawyer who was looking up this and that and the other thing, but I needed someone to talk to, or else it was all a run of, you know, to help the narration. I had needed someone, I forget his name, McCarthy, something I call him.
Now, what happened between the time of that trial and when you were tapped by Williams to sit on the court? Was there some connection there?
No, the book was accepted and published. Accepted, but not quite out. And the Williams thing intervened. I mean, after losing to Congress and finding a mountain authorium, things changed a little. And I got this case that gave me, I'd read a lot of books about trials, but here was an old battered DA that had been through a dandy, and finally, this guy from Lansing was terrific. He's pretty much as I write it. He was a terrific trial lawyer, almost too good for his case. I mean, he wanted to win. And, you've read the book, trying to keep the rape out, and the fact that the lady was beaten to hell. Really, the guy that was the interesting one in that case was the deceased. Why did he do this? What the hell did he think would happen if he beat up and raped the wife of a veteran?
Was he in a drunken rage, or was he psychotic, or what the...
I really don't know. Don't know. I knew the guy. He was the next... I didn't put this in. He was an ex-state policeman. He was a terrific officer. When he handed you a case, it was closed. He had a confession and everything. I'm beginning to see that he probably got that confession. He was a terrific cop. And he retired and ran this hotel bar up in this little town up. And that's how I, well, really, the case in the book probably, well, it helped get the kids through school.
Did it somehow, was there
It became a bestseller before the movie.
Right, I remember that.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to see if there's any connection between the book and your trial, and the fact that you were somehow tapped at a long distance for this Supreme Court opening when it came. Now, what was the magic there that you were chosen? You see, this could have been a lawyer from Detroit with a lot of political clout and money. It could have been people that...
outstate lawyer that was being... I heard, not so much then as later, he was already on a federal bench, I think, and he was going to federal district court bench.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, he became ill. And it was a question again, they needed another judge. And so they settled on Walker, and I don't know why. Perhaps because I was a bestseller.
But not then. You weren't. You hadn't made it then, had you?
Yeah, by then it was well known that I could spell
well, okay.
Fish or cat without a K and so forth.
Let me ask you a specific question about something I heard on the politics of this. Now, I was told one time that when you were being checked out for this job, that Zoltan Ferenczi and Gus Scholl were sent up here to look down your throat and to see whether you were a proper candidate for this honor. Is that right?
I don't know, but I knew both of them.
Mm-hmm.
I got to know Gus rather well. He was an interesting man.
Hell of a man, really.
Yeah. And married to a very interesting daughter of an English labor man. I forget the names now.
Mm-hmm.
But Gus Scholl was an interesting guy, and I got to know him, and Ferenczi was Ferenczi. I guess they were checking me out to see if I could speak English a little. So forth and so on. And I luckily got to know Phil Hart. I admired him very much. We took a ride campaigning once and talked a lot, not so much about politics, but many things.
He was one of God's noblemen, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a terrific person. And
family of eight kids and
magnificent personality and...
He was. Politics was so exciting back then. You know, we had Soapy and Phil Hart. I mean, it was an exciting time. I was maturing. I wasn't any longer a young lawyer, but I was in my mid-50s when I was appointed to the court, or 50s. It was 57. Yeah, I would be 54, I guess.
I'd like to ask you something that may seem so stupid in its simplicity to you, but with the passage of years, I think what you've got to say on this subject would be very, very interesting to the people that examine into the court and the judicial process. And what I would like to have you do is to recall in some detail exactly what it was that you walked into when you accepted that appointment. You went down to Lansing. I would like to know if you can remember, for example, where you slept, how many days in a row you were there, how many, did you have a secretary? Did you write your opinions in your green pen on a long paper? Did you have a law clerk?
Yes.
How did you decide these things? Did the eight of you get around that big table on the third floor down there?
We had conferences.
Uh-huh. You remember the...
What happened was, I don't know if it still happens, but at that time there was no interim appellate court. Interim appellate court. And the court was very busy with mixed cases. A lot of them had the equivalent of bed fender cases. I mean, we were getting the full rush from circuit trial courts. And at this time, there was apparently a conservative, liberal feeling in all over the country, apparently. And when I was appointed, let's see, there was George Edwards and Smith.
Talbot Smith, right?
Talbot Smith. I know Edwards well and knew Talbot well.
Gene Black.
And there was one other. Some of them, it was a chaotic time for me. I mean, a bestseller, you know, a movie, Otto, two campaigns. It's a wonder in a way that I survived the blooming thing.
But do you remember, for example, what time of the day that your meetings started and how many of them there were? And were there...
We had a meeting place. We had a room of our own, and we would meet and go over the cases. It was, what was the court, 8 then or 9?
8, right.
8? Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was about 5 and 3, the liberal. And in other words, at the time I sat there, the court was mostly inclined to be liberal.
You were said in the newspapers at the time to be the tilt vote. That is, you made the fifth for liberal interpretation of the workers' comp laws and that sort of thing.
Yeah, there was a lot of decisions. Well, you might have heard of a Dudas case too. I wrote a decision in that, and John Desmers, an old friend of mine from law school days, was the Chief Justice at that time, and a good Holland-Dutch conservative. And John and I disagreed on a lot of things, even though we remained friends. And...
You know, I went over a lot of the... the cases in your time trying to get a feel, you know, for what we're talking about. And one of the things that struck me, and I would like your thoughts on this subject, was that even though you had a split philosophically, time after time after time, cases that you wrote that came to you to prepare were either unanimous, or if they were not unanimous, there would be concur in result, you know. There was not the kind of sharp, bitter antagonism evident at that time, in my observation, that later came to tear that court apart in, you know, figurative terms. Do you have any observation or recollection of this?
Well, I think that we tried to keep it that way. I mean, I was personally and socially more acquainted with the liberal judges. There was an old judge who, once in a while, if I dissented from an opinion, I dissented with the most conservative judge.
You noticed that? Mm-hmm.
I forget his name. He is an old judge.
Wasn't Carr, was it?
Yes, Carr.
You were with Carr on a fair number of cases. He was
a shrewd, smart lawyer.
And a good judge, right?
And a good judge. He was an old-time judge. He followed the old order pretty well, you know.
Did you know that he ran an informal law school at night?
I did know that. Yeah,
back when you could read law, you know, and get your...
I was quite taken with him. Although he never became... I mean, he was considerably older, and he was a kind of a figure on a cliff, a legal kind of the Justice Holmes of the Michigan Court. And
you and Black were very close, were you not?
Yes, we were.
What did you feel, a certain chemistry together, or how do you explain your...
Well, I think part of it was gratitude. I think he had a large part. I do not yet really know. I think he had a large part in when this other judge became ill, that was going to be appointed, and seeing that I got appointed. We had met each other before. There was even any notion that I might be on the court. We had known each other. He was an interesting guy. Well,
but you were together on a lot of cases. You concurred in his dissents, or he, or the other way around. Although he was more.
Let me switch to something. Mm-hmm. Tell you a little about Gene Black.
Let me turn this thing over just a minute. See if I.
That's the end of this side.
Door is true.
I told you earlier I ran twice in a year or so, statewide, well, in those days, and it may still be. The state, most of the judges are elected on nonpartisan tickets, as is the Supreme Court. But oddly enough, for some reason, in its wisdom, the legislature provided that the Supreme Court justices should be nominated by political parties. I was nominated by the Democratic Party of Michigan, and my opponent, my second opponent, was nominated by the Republicans. And he was a young Irishman whose name I cannot remember, but the records have it.
Moynihan.
What's it, Moynihan?
Moynihan.
Oh, my God.
You remember that.
Don't you? Joe Moynihan, his dad.
Junior.
Yeah, Junior.
Junior. All right. So he was from Wayne County, but which was, of course, the biggest voting bloc in the state. And so I moved down there to campaign and lived at some place. I discovered later that it was a party motel, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, I stayed at some joint, and that didn't get out. And I guess they were, you could even park there for a few hours with a lady. I didn't know. I had a room near downtown anyway, and I was campaigning. And then the ballots came out. And I'll have to check on this, but my recollection is that Moynihan's father was an old circuit judge that had been elected and re-elected automatically for years.
Exactly correct.
He was, you know, I mean, he was...
A fixture.
A fixture in Wayne County politics. And so part of my problem was to be running against his son, Joe Moynihan Jr. Well, that was enough of a problem in itself. This name, the old saint's son was running against this guy Traver from upstate, or Volker rather. So then the ballots came out, and for some reason that I still don't know, the ballots read Joseph Moynihan, no Junior, although the lawyer that my opponent was listed in the Bar Journal and this, that, and in the telephone books as Joseph Moynihan Junior. He was a young lawyer, I guess, in Detroit, or youngish lawyer. Anyway, what to do? I had to do something. I had no proof that it was shenanigans. That it looked bad, but I had to do something. And I conferred with Gene Black. He said, "This is very serious." He knew the Moynihan situation better than I did. What a revered figure the old man was. The old gentleman, should I say, revised me. And I called the press conference after talking with Gene. And there were reporters there and Bar Association, State Bar representative, this, ladies' bar, and blah, 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 a big crowd. And we met, I forget where. And I got up and I said, "I have a statement to make about the election." I said, "I thought I was running against an opponent called Joseph Moynihan Jr." And so I asked my opponent to explain, if he can, how come he showed up at the Republican convention to be nominated, but his daddy showed up on the ballot. "Thank you, goodbye," and I walked out. And that apparently did it, with the help of bestsellerdom and God knows what. I think I carried Wayne County.
Do you? I was going to ask that.
You'd have to check it, but anyway, I won. And of course, can't say it was that conference. There were many other things, including the book, bestseller, and auto, and movies, and flying night shirts, and
Now, that was the short campaign in 57, right?
I guess it was the second one, yeah.
A short time after you had gone on the court, 3 months or something like that.
And what most of the candidates did was go from factory to General Motors and hand out cards. But I certainly discovered that while Soapy, with his 6'9" and his polka dot guy, could pass around the cards and they wouldn't throw them away, they were throwing my cards away almost before I handed them. And I finally said to myself, this is a waste of time. These people are so goddamn tired when they come out of work that they don't know me and they don't give a damn. This isn't the campaign. So anyway, I had two young guys that were helping, two young lawyers.
Who were they, do you remember by name?
Bill Ellman.
Oh, yeah.
And Damon Keith.
Oh, two young lawyers, well.
Yeah, two young lawyers. One had a brother called the writer, you know. Joyce. And anyway, we went campaigning elsewhere, and especially with Damon, among the blacks, black churches. And
was he a judge at that time, or what? Was he just a young lawyer?
Young lawyer.
And Ellman was, that was Bill Ellman?
Bill Ellman, his brother, was the writer, the well-known writer that has since died. Mm-hmm. And I've corresponded with him. I met Ellman's parents during this time. They were dear old Jewish couple, smart, lovely people. The father was a lawyer, I guess, but he should have been a poet or something. I mean, a dreamy lawyer. I mean, there are a lot of people drift into the law that should be picking apples or writing poems or some damn thing. It's like boxing. You see guys in a boxing ring, they're big, heavy, powerful guys, but they haven't learned to, they shouldn't be, they're in the wrong work. They don't fight back. If you're in the ring fighting to save yourself, if you get anything sat on your keister, you better fight back. And you can almost see it, that there's similarities anyway.
Well, you showed some of that feistiness, I thought, in a couple of your opinions, excuse me. Do you remember the dissent that you wrote on the Sunday sales ordinance in Flint, where the furniture companies were refused the right to open up on Sunday, and by the local councilman. In fact, you made in one footnote, I think in that case you talked about the rule of unassailability of aldermanic decision or something like that. Do you remember that case?
Yeah, vaguely I do.
Oh, you let them have it, I tell you. You don't remember that. Perhaps that there was an 1845 statute that preempted the whole field and said you couldn't do anything on Sunday. You couldn't brush your teeth on Sunday without a permit.
Yeah.
And
I'd have to make that signaler now, too. God, I was. Yeah. It was a wonderful, wonderful time.
Do you remember Hildebrandt? Remember that case?
Yeah, that name, yeah.
That was the nudist camp.
Was it? Yeah, I sure remember that. That was a direct, I mean, I was, the prevailing decision, the main decision was made by my friend John Deffers, the Chief Justice. And I had to... So, I was an old DA. And
well, you pulled out all the stops on that one.
I can remember that we, when I was DA, and for years before, we had this whore lady in Nagani. What was it?
Big Annie.
Yeah, Big Annie. And we talked about it, the sheriff and the officers I dealt with. She was a safety valve in the community. It was better to have a Big Annie than... But then one of Big Annie's girls began distributing, not syphilis, gonorrhea. Mm-hmm. And it got so that it was affecting the mines. She was apparently a busy girl, and there were a lot of miners that were floored by going to Big Annie's. So I called in the chief of Nagani. I said, "Chief, something's got to be done here. Would you pass the word to Big Annie to call this girl off, either have her cured or get on vacation? It's got to stop." I mean, it was affecting the mining. It was getting that bad. And he came back in about an hour. Big Annie told me to tell you to go piss up a hemp rope. Shocker. Well, all right. I said, that's direct talk. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to station a man at the... She had an upstairs entrance. Long flight of wooden stairs behind a tavern downstairs. Station a man at her, a cop, a uniformed cop, at the downstairs entrance, night and day. We gotta do it, Arnie. We gotta. And have him with a notebook, and every time someone leaves or enters, have him write his own name, the officer's name, in the notebook. And then close the notebook. If he knows the guy, a person, you know, good morning, good night. In 3 days, Big Annie surrendered. Well, in fact, she quit. I forget the details, but it worked.
Well, that's old-fashioned remedies, you know, like when the kid would get constipated. In the old days, there was always some pretty easy way to fix it without going through all the doctors. And
yeah.
Who was the police chief then? Remember, was he a good old guy to work with?
He was a good man to work. I was very lucky. I had some damn good cops, and I'm not talking politically. I mean, the county was mixed. I had during the big strike in the 40s, mid-40s, I guess it was, there was a hell of a strike. Then they settled it nationally, but it kept on up here. And we met police chiefs, sheriffs, deputies, and state police. And I said, look, pinch everybody that's wrong, company or union. Pinch them. If there's a fight or this, that, if somebody commits what appears to be a crime, pinch them. And if it's bailable, bail them out. And we pile them up. I said, if we don't, we're going to have the National Guard in here. That was the story of the Upper Peninsula for years and years. It was the way to break strike, called the National Guard. I said, we've got to be playing, no company playing or no union playing, pinch anybody that commits. Well, the pictures piled up, the cases piled up, bail, bound over to the poop-poop term of court. It was summer vacation then. What happened? They settled a strike finally, the local strike. And the state police hailed me down one day in my car. I was going, happened to be going fishing, of all things. What a coincidence. They said, Mr. Prosecutor, they settled a strike, but they want to know if you'll agree to dismiss the cases. All the cases. Oh, I said, I can't do that. Some of them are felonies, some of them are damn serious. But you could bring the word back that if Judge Bell agrees to this idea, I won't oppose it. I won't fight it. And there are still families that are split up from that very strike. Okay, there were company guys that were leading what they used to call scabs, you know, and this, it was really rough and tumble. So the cases were dismissed.
Now, was that a, were those in the iron mines, or was this a copper mining strike? This is iron around here.
No, this was involved the big, I don't know, I think it was the United Mine Workers, but it was bigger. It was a national strike that got settled nationally, but hung over here for some reason, and I forget. There's a lot of stuff I forget. Can I give you a short reading, sir?
You betcha, I'd be delighted. Honored.
Have you read a book called Laughing Whitefish?
Have not read that one, no.
Well, it involved a lawsuit over iron ore, and finally got into the Michigan Supreme Court. And I wrote a story about it called Laughing Whitefish. That did not become a bestseller or a movie. And once in a lifetime. And I tried to describe this was back in the 1870s or 80s, years ago in Lansing. And I had heard that the court that I sat in pretty much, or what, I don't know if it was the same court or it had been there for years in the old Capitol building. I guess they moved since, have they?
That's correct. On the third floor of the old Capitol building, the court took up in 1878, I think, and it sat there till 1970.
On chapter 28, on page 273 of this volume, 28 is, I tried to describe the court that I knew. The ancient Supreme Court chamber on the third floor of the domed Capitol building in Lansing looked more like the inside of an eccentric old church than a courtroom. Worn red carpeting covered every inch of the creaking floor. Ill-assorted chairs lined the walls on both sides, supplementing the plain high-back wooden benches that looked rather more like uncomfortable pews of some austere religious sect. A faded flag hung inert and listless from a floor staff near the court crier's wooden cubicle, and huge dusty portraits of beaded bygone judges seeming mostly rows of staring cataleptic eyes peering out from great thickets of whiskers and billowy yards of black felt robing, lined the walls like the forbidding images of obscure and vanished saints. That's one picture of the court that I remember.
That's the surroundings are, to me, very familiar. Now, you're talking about the courtroom itself, right?
Yeah.
And I
used to sit on the end, I think, of the Chief Justice in the middle. I sat at one end, and I could look out. It was a stuffy courtroom, and in the summer, there were elms there. And I would look out at those elms and hear the birds. I sometimes wonder if I could find a rope to get the hell out of there.
That would have been the left end of the bench, would it not?
Yes.
Where
as you face it, I would be on the audience's right. But if it...
Away from the building interior and where the windows were, over on the south exposure of the building.
Well, I was where the judges sat,
uh-huh.
which was damn close to one end of the extreme end of the building, the back end of the room, I mean.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's more, but that...
Go ahead and read some more of it.
It was an unreasonably hot morning in mid-June and kind of sticky, enervating heat one rarely encounters farther north. Several of the tall windows of the courtroom had been cautiously raised, supported by most unimpeachable authority, bound volumes of Michigan Law Reports, and some of the reaching leafy branches of the stately Capitol elms seemed almost to nod in our laps. Are those elms still there?
There are a good many now. Tied them with steel bars and wires, and they preserved as many as possible. And there are a good number of them.
Birds twittered and squirrels scolded noisily with a fine contempt of court. And occasionally from far below I could hear the distant clapping of a horse's hooves along the cobbled streets. Well, a little historic poo-poo. Well, it goes on and on.
You know, the reason I wanted to get your recollections on the particulars of how you went about deciding these cases is that...
I must interrupt. At my age, I get attacks of your analysis.
Well, I think we all do.
Yeah. There's one in there around the...
Okay, thank you.
I'll be back.
Yeah.
If you had 3 weeks, I'd show you something.
Oh, you know, if you would pick up, you know how the books are bound, Michigan Reports. I brought up 347 to 358 just in case there might be some occasion that you want to look at one of those things or refresh your memory or read some of it. And if you would look in the front of one of those books, you know, it has the names of all the incumbent justices and the end of their term, who's the clerk, and that's about it. If you would pick up the most recent issue of the Michigan Reports, be 440 or something like that, you'd see the names of the members of the court, and you would also discover that there are listed maybe 15 commissioners. And there are some others, assistant clerk and that sort of stuff, and the crier. And I just wondered if you realize the enormous difference in the fabric of the Supreme Court as it is structured today as against the time when you sat there. That's why I wanted to encourage you to talk about what you remember. You know, what kind of a table it was. What did you do when you needed to get a copy of something? You didn't have any copiers. You didn't have a law clerk, did you? Did you have a secretary at your side all the time?
I not down there. I had a clerk, and an assistant up here.
Mm-hmm.
Down there, I was kind of on my own. It was very old-fashioned and slow.
Do you remember the phrase window matters and where that came from?
No.
Window matters were, they got their name because the record was put on the windowsill. They didn't have another place to put it. And these were, as I recall, motion cases where, for example, there was a motion for a stay or there was an application for leave or something like that where the case wasn't through the front door. You know, you weren't entertaining the thing in a plenary sense. And I suspect those were the only copies of the record and you had to...
I have forgotten a lot of the mechanics of the car. I do remember that it was a busy try and an almost exalting experience. I mean, here's a country lawyer that finally found himself on the state's top court. And I doubt that I'd even seen the room before. And here I was sitting in it, in a black nightshirt. And trying to look judicial. And I wouldn't have missed it, and I wouldn't want to go through it again.
When it came time in 1959 for you to go through another campaign, do you remember what the circumstances were? Now, you were later, some of the Republican senators got on your case and criticized you for running, winning an 8-year term.
And resigning.
Yes. Now, what do you recall about that part of your career?
I discovered that I decided that my life was getting so complicated, what with writing and movies and bestsellers and this bestseller. I mean, that doesn't happen to a lot of old experienced writers. And here was a XDA with a national bestseller, and, you know, all this hoopla, Johnny Carson calling, and this one, come and see it. And I was going through that too. I went through it. I probably wouldn't again, but that was the way it was. And I decided that I'd better, well, one thing, my old circuit judge told me after this, or did he live into that? My old circuit judge, Judge Bell, was an old friend. We became friends. And he was an old woodsman. We fished, I'd take him fishing. I mean, we liked each other, kind of a rare thing to like the your sitting judge. And when he retired, I'd go and visit him at his house and wind up with a bit of bourbon, maybe.
Old cordwood, maybe?
Yeah, I forget. And he told me about the case. It was actually three cases that made up Laughing Whitefish, the book you I guess you have read it.
No.
It's really a historical novel, or as one reviewer said it, hysterical, which made me laugh. Ha ha. Har. Yeah. It's the only one I ever wrote. I did a lot of research on it. And I wanted to write it But no time. It was too busy. We still didn't have the interim appellate court. Busier than hell. The Supreme Court job was the busiest job I ever had in my life. And up here during strikes and things, it was pretty busy being DA. And the pressure was too much, and I could afford, finally. I mean, some guys work at things they hate because they cannot afford not to. They have families and responsibilities. I could afford not to, and I figured that while, as I wrote Soapy, finally, when I resigned, I'm sorry, Governor, but while other men may write my opinions, they can scarcely write my books. And goodbye and thank you. And I miss Soapy, and I'm saddened that he's dead. He was quite a man.
He was, and he lived a long, full life, really.
Yes, he did. He did.
Do you recall in the spring, in those days, in those times, the Supreme Court justices were elected in the spring election, were they not?
That was right.
So yes. You ran in, let's say, April?
For yeah. I think even in May.
Uh-huh. For an eight-year term that was to start after the year had ended, correct? Your term that you were running for in those times didn't start until...
No, I think it was in June. We had roughly four terms. And there was a June, that was the longest off period. There was a fall term, the winter term, the Christmas term, the early spring term, and the summer term. I guess there were roughly four terms. And
how long would you spend in Lansing during those?
I got out of Lansing as fast as I could.
I mean, would that be a matter of a few weeks, though, or longer?
Well, yeah, it's just we had to get down there. I mean, before the court started, we reviewed the cases and things that were coming up. There weren't all big cases. There were motions and God knows what.
How did you travel in those days? Did you travel by car or by train?
Well, I think there were still a few trains, but I drove a lot. And I remember coming home in a snowstorm from Lansing and landing at the Straits and wanting to get home and driving in a blind snowstorm. The only way I could see the road was to see the banks that the plows had left. I could not see the road. And still I made it. It was almost suicidal, crazy to do. But I got home and figured that this sort of thing had got to stop. I knew that I didn't want to spend any more time in Lansing than was necessary. I wanted to get home to my family and my back roads and fishing and all the things that really count, sir. No, I'm kidding.
You know, in your getting back to your cases, in the magic of modern technology, you know, you spit certain things in the machine and they'll bring up all the titles. You know that, I guess.
I guess so.
And I got all your dissents and all the cases that you wrote majority opinions in. And it's interesting to me that the way it came out was that you were the author of 94 opinions, at least by what this computer scan shows, and you were
listed as a dissenter in only 14 cases, of which you must have written probably 6 or 7 and concurred in dissents in other cases. Now, what I see in this, and what I'd like to call to your attention, is that there were about 6 cases that you wrote, you were the author of those cases, to every one where you found it necessary to be recorded as against the majority. I did the same thing for Justice Lindemer, who served back in the 76. And he came out an even number. Forget whether it's 22 and 22. He wasn't on the court too long. But I just, if you recall, I would like to hear your thoughts about the fact that for a lot of the recent history, there has been evidence of a lot of strife and division.
In the present court?
Well, not so much. I'm not thinking of right now, but in the recent last couple of decades.
I see.
And back when you served, there must have been a different atmosphere, and I suspect it was one of civility and don't beat the other guy's brains out. You can disagree, but say, well, okay, I disagree.
We tried to avoid personalities, rancor. We tried to, even if we disagreed, we tried to be judicial about it.
Mm-hmm. And concur in the result, or?
Well, I mean, that dissent from Deathers, John Deathers, my old friend, was kind of rough and tough, but respectful. I respected his view. He was taking the traditional view of nudity. And I forget the exact charge. God,
what it turned on in your analysis was illegal search. The cops came, remember, one time.
Oh, yeah.
And they were snooping.
Yeah.
And they did it under the guise of a warrant. Then, and there was some more.
They knew that the thing had been there for years. Yes. It was an old time, and it mostly family thing. And it was a raw case. It was the wrong case for a nudity thing, and I couldn't swallow it, and I dissented, and got enough votes, I guess it.
You did. Bad. Edwards concurred in the result in that case. Do you remember that?
No, Edwards, I don't.
Well, Edwards was the 4th vote.
Oh.
And he apparently didn't want to go along with some of your rhetoric. And you went into this thing in considerable detail.
I did.
Both legally and in the rhetorical way. And I got the book out there if you have any yen to see what it looks like. I didn't bother to bring it in there from the car, but I would guess offhand that your opinion, which was labeled dissent, but got 4 votes and became the opinion of the court, probably ran 25 or 30 pages. And in those days, that was a lot of pages.
Yeah, I got into that. It was a tough one. It was a tough one. There's no doubt that it was a place where people could go and take off their clothes and relax with their children and so forth. And
there was a passage.
Yeah. Let me, before I forget it. At that time, apparently, I was being interviewed in some life. Photographer was up here and he wanted to interview me and take some pictures. And one of them he wanted to take was in a Finnish sauna. So I was on the court then, and I was wary enough to not want to be on the sauna alone. So I got a young lawyer friend to sit with me in the sauna with a towel over. We were bare eyes, excuse me, idiom creeps out, with a towel over where the towel should be. And he took a picture of many pictures, local and fishing and so forth. And it wasn't life, but time, I guess. Time ran a picture. They got it from life, apparently, about the nudist judge who had written the opinion. And they didn't say I was a nudist, but the picture they showed was without the lawyer and without the towel. I don't know what the hell they did with the towel, but... And the implication was that I was a nudist writing an opinion. Prevailing opinion, sustaining nudity. So I wrote, it's the only letter I ever wrote to a periodical. But it was a dirty trick, and somebody had planned it. It was a false picture. And I said, you know damn well that a lawyer that was a nudist, if he were a nudist, a judge would not be sitting on the case. He would either withdraw voluntarily, or he wouldn't be permitted to sit on the case.
Do you recall that in the course of the writing the case, there was a passage where you said, now, despite all that I am writing here, I want to make it clear that I have no sympathy with... Start where you started before, Judge.
I will now read a passage from 358 Michigan Report, beginning on page 578, and an opinion I wrote back in 1958. Lest I henceforth be heralded as the patron saint of nudism, paren, which I probably will be anyway, end of parenthesis, I hasten to preface what follows by stating that I am not a disciple of the cult of nudism. Its presumed enchantments totally elude me. The prospect of displaying my unveiled person before others or beholding others thus displayed revolts and horrifies me. I think these people have carried an arguably valid basic idea, the deliberate de-emphasis of the prevailing Western body taboo, with the anticipated lessening and ultimate disappointment of the undoubted eroticism frequently attended upon such taboos. Such taboo that is the very opposite of indecency, end of parenthesis, to excessive length. I haven't read this in a long time. Are you still there?
You bet.
Having said all that, I have at once veered to the heart of this case. It is this, : whether I or my associates or the circuit judge or the prosecutor or the police, for that matter, may personally think of the practice of nudism had nothing to do with the case. Or controlling is the fact that there are a number of earnest people in this world, including these defendants, who do subscribe to organized nudism and who think that it is morally, mentally, and physically helpful. But we need not speculate on or defend or attack the philosophy of nudism. The question before the court is much simpler. Were these defendants guilty of making an indecent exposure? I say no. It is said that there are hardy bands of sincere and earnest folks among us who likewise insist that all mental, moral, and physical health depends absolutely upon the regular consumption of vast quantities of bran. Others possess a similar passion for goat's milk. Few molest them or even bother their heads about them unless they try too strenuously to impose or inflict their queer beliefs upon those who happen to know these items. Thus, of the facts before us, do I equate the criminality of private social nudism, at least so far as violation of this statute is concerned. Private fanaticism, or even bad taste, is not yet a ground for police interference. If eccentricity were a crime, then all of us were felons.
That's a good, don't you like that? Aren't you proud? I think that's pretty good stuff.
I like it. I worked hard on it. Yeah, I must have stayed up late that night.
Judge, I don't want to, you know, they say that I would dearly love to go on and hear some more of what you are willing to talk about, but I know that it's going to soon become an imposition if it hasn't already, and I'm going to take my leave. If you are willing, you think that it makes any sense, I'd like to come back for another helping tomorrow morning. If you say it doesn't, I'm not going to argue the point at all, because I feel very grateful to you for what you've done to this point.
If you talk to George, you need, it's up to you.
Okay.
Is to...
We're talking about George Edwards, seeing his...
is to corrupt the old idea of socialism. The people's right. I'm not making a speech for socialism, but it was at least an arguable political proposition. And communism has been so confused with socialism that, to use the word, I mean, it's almost as bad as calling someone a liberal. Damn near.
You know that when... He went up for confirmation, George Edwards went before the Senate Judiciary Committee when he was nominated to be a U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals judge. Remember that in about the early 60s. This all came back to haunt him, and the people there, including some of the old Bourbons from the South, look right square down his throat, but he had such good support, and he had such good answers, and he said he was so disarming in his candidness, at least this is my analysis, that his nomination was accepted without too much rancor.
Everett Dirksen, I think, got on it pretty hard.
Yeah, I remember dear Everett.
The Wizard of Ooze.
Wizard of Ooze is right. Yeah, and his son-in-law Baker, is it? Baker,
I think, was his son-in-law.
Baker's daughter, yeah. Yeah. A very interesting guy, not equated with Everett. Yeah.
I thought he served very creditably, Baker.
Yeah.
And remember at one time, apparently he thought he
Some of my best friends are Republican. Admission. Yeah.
By the way, for the benefit of the tape, I want to make it, to make the announcement here between you and me and for anybody that will listen in the future, that this is October 1st, 1990.
Oh, okay.
And this is former Justice John D. Volker sitting in his chair in his living room in a remote setting outside of Ishpeming. And this is Roger Lane doing the, talking. And this is all for the benefit of the Michigan Supreme Court Historical Society Oral History Project. And that's what we're here for.